Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering, because you conclude on equality, but you don't really have an overlay on equality.
Yeah.
You talk about growth per capita. What happened to equality in St. Louis?
Well, you know, that really depends on how you... What happened to inequality and equality during this period. And that really depends on how you measure it, because there's a lot of different ways you can measure between countries, within countries. You can, you know, measure it worldwide with, obviously, China and India dominate the scene. It's not clear. It really, you really have to, it's not really clear, to me at least, what happened to overall. Clearly, there were some places where inequality increased. And but there's no the only statement I made there was that most of the reduced progress you would see was a result of the growth slowdown. Now, that's not to say that inequality is not a problem or that there shouldn't be redistribution. The UNDP's latest report actually had a section on that showing how much could be done simply through redistribution and how, in terms of meeting the, you know, Millennium Development Goals, that there would need to be redistribution as well as growth. And so I don't want to minimize that at all. I've had the emphasis on growth because that's been ignored. The press has talked about inequality and poverty. Well, you can follow up and then I'll take another one. It really varies. I mean, there's just a, you know, first of all, you're starting out with a distribution that's really different in the world, right? Latin America has, what happens to countries? The question was, what happens in countries that grow faster? Does inequality increase? Over the long haul, I mean, there's no historical data indicating that there's an actual trade-off between growth and inequality, if that's what you mean. In fact, most of what I've seen, it tends to lean the other way. That, and you know, the Asian countries, for example, that had the highest growth rates of the successful Asian countries, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, that had the high growth rates, you know, in the post-World War II period, tended to have less unequal distributions than others. The worst is Latin America, of course. The ratio of the income of top 10% in Brazil to the bottom 10% is about 85-1. It's about 17 in the United States, and it's gotten a lot worse here in the last 30 years. Yeah.
In China in particular, the government is very concerned about the inequality and its emergence, rural versus urban.
Yeah, the question is how well does it represent, the GDP per capita represent what's happened in China over the last 25 years, given the lack of, or the poor distribution, especially in the countryside. Well, there's no doubt. I mean, you can look at the numbers. You know, the World Bank has them by region, and I don't have them with me, but you can see it is very much like two different countries. You know, some of the regions where you have per capita income of, you know, 23,000, you know, almost European, basically European level per capita income, and then you have regions where it's in the low thousands, you know, purchasing power parity basis. So there's huge differences. A lot of people have been left behind in absolute numbers, but there's no doubt that it still trickles down. I mean, overall, the vast majority of the country has experienced a big increase in their income, simply, and I'm not defending it, I'm just saying that there's no doubt that last 25 years has done a lot for the vast majority of people in China, just economically. Yes.
China is an exception than India.
Well, the question is, what happened to human development indicators, like the Human Development Index, you mean, of the UNDP? Is that
what? Yeah,
oh, what are those? Oh, yeah. I looked at that in the data that we had to see what happened to China. And its improvement in the social indicators during the second period was about on par with what you would expect with the rest of the group in their income level. You would have expected more, but the trouble is, well, for one thing, is they their life expectancy even in 1980 was relatively high for their level of income, which was pretty poor. So I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was already quite high for their income level. So that's one of the reasons why you didn't see as much improvement as you would expect from this kind of growth. Yeah.
On your last chart.
Yes, you do have. Obviously, you're going to have some. Well, it depends what country you compare it to in Latin America. The question was how much of China and India's faster growth is attributable to the fact that they're starting out at a lower level than, for example, Latin America. I'm not really comparing them, you know, to Latin America. I mean, really, the example, the thing that was exceptional about them is that they, despite the trend in the world among low and middle income countries towards slower growth in the second period, these are two countries that had much more rapid growth in the second period than the first. But no, I don't think you can really attribute that difference to where they're starting out. Look where Africa started out, for example. They had negative growth in the second period of income per person. They're starting out at a very low level. So again, depending on who you're comparing to, sure, there's always some advantage to starting out at a lower level in the sense that you can make faster gains. But I don't know that you see that much diminishing returns until you get to the really high income levels of almost, you know, the United States and Europe. Yeah. Margareta.
When you talked about how this decade might also be difficult for Latin America in the first place.
Oh, that's a good point. She asked, given all the elections that you've had in Latin America of presidents running against the what they call neoliberalism and the reforms of the last 25 years, has anything turned around or are things turning around? Well, I think there are two examples of some things that did turn around. In Argentina, you did have a very compelling example of a government that refused to take any more of the IMF's advice, had a very strong base of support for standing up to them. That was Kirchner's governor. And in 2002, they received no money at all from the IMF or the multilaterals. In fact, the IMF and the other institutions drained about 4% of their GDP out of the country when they were in the depression. And they did recover very quickly. They had only 3 months of decline after the default. And since the last 2.5 years, they've grown at almost 9% overall, which is very fast growth. And it's a very robust recovery as well. So I think that's definitely a success story, an example of a government that did at least some of what it promised. It promised to chart a different course, and it was successful in doing so. The other example I would say is Venezuela, because that government promised to share its oil wealth with the majority of the country, which is poor, and did so. They have, you know, subsidized food now for 40% of the population, free health care for most of the poor people, almost all, really, and a big increase in spending on social spending, education spending, literacy programs. So they really did do that. In terms of their growth for the 6 years of the Chavez government is about flat in terms of per capita income, which is not very good. But on the other hand, the 28 years before him, you had a 35% decline in per capita income. So it's not a much of an achievement, but at least they did reverse the long decline, which was one of the worst in Latin America and even the world. So those are the two that I would point to as actually implementing some of the changes that they promised. In Venezuela, it was more distributive, but in Argentina, it was more just macroeconomic policy that restored the country to a healthy rate of growth. Yeah. Yeah, so she's asking about dollarization and how that affects growth or what that's like for an exchange rate policy. It never made a lot of sense to me to fix your currency. It's one thing for the European Union to have a common currency if most of their trade is with each other. It's quite different to tie your currency to the dollar if you have only a relatively small amount of trade with the United States, and the country gives up its ability to use monetary policy and interest rate policy to affect the economy. So I would that doesn't mean it's bad in all cases. Like, it's just like these fixed exchange rate policies that I went through in Argentina and Russia, and I didn't mention Brazil, but that was another big disaster in the 90s. At first, those fixed exchange rate policies played a positive role because the exchange rate served as a nominal anchor to take down inflation. So in some cases, if you have hyperinflation, it might... it's an extreme policy, though. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I don't know that it's... would show up in these numbers in terms of growth, because it wasn't that many countries adopted it. Yeah, in the back.
To what extent do the decline in growth rates correspond to declines in commodity prices?
He's asking how much did declines in commodity prices influence this phenomenon that we saw in terms of declining growth rates? Well, that's a good question. There definitely was a decline in most of the commodities that the low and middle income countries exported during this period. I think it did contribute. I couldn't give you a percentage, but I think it was probably significant. It was almost certainly significant.
Sometimes the flat growth rates would occur in commodity prices.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, he said, what would it look like if you plotted them? I don't think it would match that much. I mean, one commodity is oil, too. So that's gone in a different direction. And actually, in the last...
I mean, if the oil prices decline for a long piece of the time.
No, that's right. That's right. It is definitely part of the story, but it's also captured in the development and macroeconomic story in the sense that... part of the reasons that countries had development strategies in the 60s and 70s is because it was a conscious decision on the part of the governments not to have their country be dependent on primary commodity exports for their future. And so the abandonment of those strategies increased the vulnerability of a lot of countries to those kinds of shocks. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so she's asking the big question, which is how much did these reforms of the last 25 years have to do with the failure that we saw? And we try to not make sweeping statements that can't be backed up by the evidence. I'm not going to say that it was all a result of, I mean, obviously there are other things that went on. There's wars and civil conflicts in Africa, for example, that contributed to the mortality rates that you saw. That was part of it. They still show up if you take sub-Saharan Africa out of there. So it's not the whole story at all on the mortality rates, life expectancy, the AIDS crisis. There are other things going on, especially in the poorest countries. But overall, I would say that the policy mistakes had a huge impact. even the ones that you can't really measure. The abandonment of development policy, I would argue, just on the basis of a historical argument, if you look at all the countries that did reach a high level of income, like the United States, the European countries, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, they all had various policies to promote the development of their industries. They had a very conscious strategy, including the United States, which, you know, had the highest tariff levels in the world from 1870 to about 1913. So they used various strategies to promote their industrialization and their development. And I think it's pretty obvious that without that, it's pretty hard to get anywhere. So that's part of the story. The failed macro policies are part of the story. The interest rates are a huge part. I mean, look at Brazil today. Their interest rate is 19.5%. That's the overnight rate set by the central bank, which is 3.75 in the United States. And sure, their inflation is a little higher than ours, but it's not that high. And, you know, how does an economy grow with that kind of interest rate at all? I mean, think of what we would have here if we had interest rates, if our Fed raised our interest rates to 19.5%. I mean, or anything close to that, we would have a very serious recession. And it would take a long time for the economy to even adapt to that kind of interest rate level before it would grow, probably. So you can point to a lot of policies that are responsible for this. There are arguments on the other side for some of them, but I think it's pretty hard to avoid just by looking at the data. It's very hard to avoid the conclusion that, and again, if you look at country by country, it's very hard to avoid the conclusion that these policy mistakes had a big impact. Yeah.
Just to kind of take a counterexample of, a leftist getting elected.
Okay, the question is about Argentina and Brazil and whether Brazil has followed the right policies or not, that they should have done more of what Argentina did in terms of defying the financial markets and the IMF and everyone else and sticking to the program on which the Workers' Party and Lula ran for office, which was a very hard critique of exactly those policies, the high interest rate policies. They had proposed an industrial strategy and a lot of other things, and they didn't implement those. And the question is, are they wrong? Well, yeah, I would say that they're wrong. I think that it was a mistake. I have to qualify it a little bit because it wasn't that easy. Argentina had already been through hell, and their default was kind of forced upon them, and so it would be a serious risk to. Even to lower interest rates, the financial markets would react badly. They don't have an IMF agreement now. But to pursue the strategies and they wouldn't be able to do all these things at once. There would have to be some sequencing. But I do think that they're never going to restore any kind of reasonable growth rate unless they abandon some of the policies that they have now that really are, both the extremely high interest rates, the tight fiscal policies. These are policies that they inherited from the previous government. And it's not to say that they need to default on their debt or anything like that, but they are going to have to change their... This is something I didn't get into, but your monetary policy very often can't be decided independent of exchange rate policy because it affects it. So if your interest rates go up and it increases the value of your currency, that affects your economy through exports. And that's very often, that's a very big thing sometimes in Latin America. And so Argentina pursued different exchange rate policies as well. And it's clear that I think, Brazil is going to probably change its macroeconomic policies at some point. The only question is when. Yes. Well, he's asking why would they change their policies? The economy is growing at 3% a year. Interest rates are coming down. And their exchange rate has stabilized. Well, it's actually appreciated quite a bit this year. Well, I think that, first of all, they've only had about, a year and a half of decent growth. If you look at any period, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, you're looking at terribly low growth rates. And 3% for a developing country, that would be, with their population growth, that's about, 1.8. It's not anything particularly good. It isn't enough to make much of a dent in unemployment. It isn't enough to get out of the budget problems that they have, given their debt and the primary fiscal surplus that they're running. So there's very little that the government can deliver for people under this kind of a growth rate. And to tell you the truth, they're very vulnerable as soon as, this is with extremely low U.S. Treasury rates. As soon as that goes up again, they're going to have a debt problem again like they had in 2002. So I don't anticipate that they're going to have any kind of sustained growth that can deliver anything without changing their economic policies. Yes. Yes, I didn't get into that. The question is about debt and how much that affects the picture that we're looking at. And obviously it does. It drains resources from south to north. You have the developing world as a whole is really supplying capital to the north, which is the opposite of the way it's supposed to go in the textbooks. The rich countries are supposed to seek a higher return in the developing countries, and capital is supposed to flow from the rich to the poorer countries. It affects policy in other ways, in that, as you, I think, hinted at, it constrains the countries, especially the ones, you have the IMF, which in the past has, and still today, acts as a creditor's cartel, kind of a, at the head of a creditor's cartel, where they get to say, okay, if you don't accept the policies that we give you, the macroeconomic policies, then you're not going to get money from the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the G7 countries, sometimes even the private sector. Now, that's changed some. That's changed significantly in the last few years because the Asian countries, after the Asian financial crisis, East Asian crisis, they piled up enormous reserves so they don't have to go back to the IMF. And then after Argentina showed that you really could stand up to them and do quite well, the middle-income countries are not as susceptible to the IMF's dictates, but they nonetheless, the debt is a huge problem, and I think you're going to see more countries. Well, look, Nigeria took a much harder line in the recent negotiations than other countries, and their parliament voted to default, and they had some bargaining. Now, whether they got a reasonable deal is still up in the air, but the point is, you're going to see more of that kind of hard bargaining, where countries realize that it doesn't make sense to just keep paying, borrowing to pay interest and borrowing to pay interest indefinitely and never have foreign capital actually contribute to your growth and development. That kind of story doesn't make sense and isn't one that should be pursued indefinitely. It's 8 o'clock, so we'll take one or two more and then we'll have to quit. Go ahead, David. Okay, so the first question is about countries wanting to avoid cutting down on carbon emissions because they're afraid that it will slow their growth. And the second one is, why do countries want to join the WTO? That's going to be a question we'll deal with next week, actually, about trade, when we look at trade issues in some detail. But for the first part, I really haven't looked at that issue in enough to tell you how much in what country compliance with the Kyoto Protocol would affect their growth. I mean, other than for the richer countries, but I haven't really looked at the issue in developing countries.
Well, what about, just forget about greenhouse gas questions. There's all kinds of other kinds of environmental pollution that will affect
you. Yes. Okay, so he's saying you all often get this debate about, countries that want to, or NGOs even, who want to who are advocating sustainable development strategies, environmentally sustainable development strategies. They say, well, if you do this, you're not going to have growth and you're not going to be able to do anything for people. Well, I think that really the biggest answer to that is look at what the unsustainable policies have produced in the last 25 years in terms of growth. It's a pretty bad record. Now, it is possible to do worse. But the point is, it's not as though the disregard for the environment that you've had has led to rapid growth overall. I mean, you have a growth failure, so clearly some other development policies are necessary. But I don't really accept that there's a huge trade-off between growth and the environment. A lot of economic growth is productivity growth, right? I mean, that's most of what we're talking about here, other than increases in employment. And so it doesn't necessarily have to lead to a greater use of natural resources. Okay, I think that's it. Thanks to everyone for coming, and I'll be around here for a little bit if you have more questions.